Good evening. This evening, in our White House Press Corps course, we are going to be lucky to have two people, one of whom has not yet come, but Don Gagne of National Public Radio, who was supposed to be here this evening, is on his way to New Hampshire to cover McCain's announcement for the presidency. And David Green, who covers the White House for NPR, is going to be with us after he files his story. And we have now Julie Mason, who has covered the White House for the Houston Chronicle. And she has a blog, Newswatch White House, and we're going to talk to her about all of the different types of journalism that she has done. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
And what I'd like to start off with is our students are always interested in how you got the job you got. And where did you start out? Were you always interested in journalism?
I was always interested. My mother always wanted to be a journalist, and she didn't have the chance because she was born in the 1920s. So when I was growing up, she always instilled in me this idea that journalism was a good job to do. So I came here to Washington to American University, and I got kicked out my sophomore year. My grade point average was like a 0.19 or something. It was ridiculous. And she was very angry, and she wanted me to come home. And I didn't want to go home. I wanted to stay here in Washington. So I crazy ran around, found a part-time job at the Dallas Morning News, and convinced her that I should stay here and pursue, you know, our dream. And so I did, and I stayed at the Morning News for 3 years. I started out just making coffee and answering phones. But at the end of 3 years, I was covering air safety. So they moved me to Dallas. And so that's how I got my start. One day, my bureau chief came to me and said, are you finished with school? I said, yes, I am. And it's a terrible way to start your career. And I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. But really, in order to succeed, I had to fail in a colossal 19-year-old kind of way. And it really worked out.
So it it really made you pull your ideas together of what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I was really, I think in both cases, if I had either gone the straight route and finished college and done internships the way you're supposed to do it, I wouldn't have gotten as far as I have now. I really had to screw up to achieve. And if I had gone home like my mother had wanted me to and finished community college in Massachusetts or something like that, that also nothing would have come of that. So I feel like it was a series of accidents, misfortunes, and personal malfeasance that got me where I am.
Luck tends to be something, and being at the right place at the right time.
Grabbing opportunities,
right.
Definitely.
That seems to be a thread through most of the people that we've talked to.
Yeah.
In the courses you had, did you take journalism courses?
I did.
And so you knew what you were interested in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'd come to Washington with that in mind.
When did you start covering the White House?
I was the number two correspondent for the first term. I was the fill-in. There was a regular correspondent, Bennett Roth, from our paper. And he did it full-time, and then when there were trips or events that he didn't want to cover, I'd do it. I did most of his pool assignments and Crawford and things like that. So I really kind of got my feet wet in the second term, and then in the first term, and then when the second term came around, I was made the correspondent. So it's just been a few years.
In looking at the beat, what do you think is a presidential story?
A presidential story.
Yeah. What do you think when you're thinking of what should be covered, and what you wanted to cover about the president?
Oh, what I wanted to cover. You know, I was interested in how he would lead. Obviously, I knew him when he was governor of Texas. I was a reporter in Austin when he was governor, so I was very interested in how he'd make that transition. And obviously, when the war came along, that became the big story. But I'm always interested in his interactions with other leaders because they're very fraught, and it's never smooth or easy for him. And so it was more a personal story. I mean, obviously, I'm interested in the big issues as well, but everyone covers the big issues. But I felt like coming from Texas and knowing him and his family and his friends, I had a certain perspective on who he was that had a different kind of edge.
And what do you find? Compare what you see now, like, say, the relationship he had as governor with the legislature.
It's totally different. Uh-huh. It's totally different. I mean, they loved him. They helped him. And there was a real comity between Republicans and Democrats there. He had a mentor in Bob Bullock, who was the lieutenant governor of Texas. And that made him able to get a lot of things done, even for a governor with limited ability, limited authority, limited sort of, you know, things that he can
do.
Yeah. And here it's just nothing but trouble, especially now.
And why do you think that happened? Is it something to do with him, or is it the difference in the environments?
Both. It's both. He doesn't work well with others, and it is also the environment. Washington is much more partisan, much more ferocious environment than Texas, than Austin, Texas. And mm-hmm. he hasn't made the transition well. Especially now with the Democratic Congress, you see the sort of difficulties he's had in maneuvering that relationship. Whereas, you know, it was great when it was a Republican Congress, but now not so much for him.
Uh-huh. What was he like, say, as a governor? What kinds of things was he interested in? Do you see some similarities, like in education, social security,
things like that.
At that time,
the interests haven't changed that much. One place where you see him having trouble with that is immigration. He was governor of Texas. He was much more pro-immigrant, you know, everyone getting along, and it's all great, and it's a good thing that people want to come across the border and live in our state. He thought that was wonderful. And now he's sort of forced to take this other position of being much more hard-headed on immigration than he feels naturally. And you can see he's not able to get much done.
Uh-huh. Well, immigration really has proved to be such a tough issue. But he seems to have been pressing to do something about it, you know, to try to continue to have the same kind of policy that he was interested in, the guest worker program.
Yeah, definitely. He could have left it alone.
Uh-huh.
One thing I noticed that I want to mention is the difference in how he treats women when he was governor compared to now. And especially women correspondents. He used to be much friendlier and forthcoming with women journalists. I've seen him on more than one occasion be flirty or give noogies back in Texas. And here he's very, very standoffish with women correspondents.
And what do you attribute it to?
There's a difference in the correspondence, but also I actually asked Josh Bolton about it one time. He had an off-the-record dinner with us, and I asked, why is he like that? And Josh was saying that it's because the president is afraid that he's going to commit some horrible faux pas, you know, that he's an earthy guy, he likes fart jokes, and he's afraid of offending, you know, the sort of uptight feminist female correspondent that he finds here in Washington.
In Washington, uh-huh. But I guess that's true about the relationship altogether mm-hmm. with the press, mm-hmm. that it's much more difficult.
Well, yeah, but he had those same, you remember in the first term when he was giving out all those nicknames and he had those great avuncular friendships with the male correspondents, and he never had that with women.
It seemed to end pretty quickly, though.
Yeah,
I think it ended about April, March or April of that year, because it didn't look good for anybody.
Mm-mm.
It in a way wasn't a recognition of the place of both. When you report, when you're thinking of your job as a reporter, where does the public fit in?
Oh gosh, well, my job as a reporter has changed materially since January. I was the correspondent, and then they told me that that I henceforth was going to be a columnist and blogger, and not be writing for the paper so much anymore. And so as a result, my interaction with the public has grown exponentially, because I deal with public comments all the time and reader comments, and I have a much more day-to-day relationship with readers than I did before.
Well, let's explore it. But okay. Let's go back before, when you were working on a story. Mm-hmm. What idea did you have in your mind of who your reader? Did you have an idea of who your reader is?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I lived in Houston for 13 years, so I felt I knew the readers, knew what they wanted to know about what Bush was up to, and I kept them in mind a lot. And the city of Houston is predominantly Democratic, but then it's ringed by very conservative suburbs. So there's a real, you know, mm-hmm. difference of opinion among the readers. But they want to know, they want information, but they're also very interested in Bush and Mrs. Bush personally, and their uh-huh. family. They're very personally interested in what they're up to. So that was also something that I covered a lot.
Uh-huh. Do you feel that the reporters work as surrogates for the public?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think sometimes we get caught up in disputes and fights that the public really isn't interested in. But when it comes to the big issues that really affect people, like Social Security, for example, I mean, the reporting on those issues were exhaustive and went into detail, and immigration as well, on how what was being proposed would affect regular people. And so I think in that it's a very good public service. But I do think we get sidetracked by these little fights and disputes.
Uh-huh. In discussions with, you know, with your organization and with other reporters on your paper, did you find that that there was a discussion of what the public wanted to know about issues? Like, say, when you are doing immigration, is there a discussion about what the public wants? I mean, the public in terms of in Houston, your
in
readers.
In Houston, yeah. There's a lot of pressure to come up with local angles to national stories.
Uh-huh.
Incredible pressure. And oftentimes, if you can't deliver a local angle, if you can't find someone in Houston directly involved in an issue or something like that, or to comment on an issue, the story dies. They won't run the story, or they'll run a shorter wire version. So there's a lot of pressure for that. I'm not sure how important that is. I guess it is.
Uh-huh. When you're working on an issue, what are all the sides you have to look at? Like, say, on something like immigration, what are the various pieces of the story? Say the president wants the guest worker program. What are some of the things that would go in, be elements of that story, of what you'd look for?
Well, you'd look for the advocacy groups, you know, who are very much for more lenient immigration policies, and then the other groups that are much more conservative, like the Minutemen, say. And then, of course, you go up to the Hill, and you'd have to find the Republicans who are for it and the Republicans who are against it. I mean, you just try to get as much varied opinion as you can, and that certainly represents this public viewpoint in Texas.
Uh-huh. And then you'd get, say, the Texas viewpoint, the national viewpoint,
right,
as well.
And certainly what the Texas members of Congress are thinking.
Come on and join us, David.
Here's our friend.
Yes, yes.
Students in the room.
They are, look ahead of you in the monitor, or look behind us. They are there
in
Baltimore.
Hi.
And so we have David Green of National Public Radio. Who?
Yes, yeah. Mic up.
Who was a correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, so you might have read him. With the Baltimore Sun. So we've been talking about White House stories and what the components are of a White House story. And so Julie was talking about the different parts and looking at immigration. When you're working on immigration, on this side?
Yeah.
So try it on this side, because since we're over here.
On the outside, though, ideally.
We got this going. We're in radio.
would they have you travel to events?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I love that.
And can you tell us about some of the border events that the president has had?
Yeah, he does a lot on the border. He likes it down there. He likes the weather. But for one thing, I would note is that he always wants the sun behind him. So the audiences always sit with the sun in their faces, and you see them just sweating and sort of falling asleep. But he always has to have the sun behind him when he does those events. It's very hot out there. But
he's not squinting.
Yeah, so
right?
He's not squinting. Yeah, yeah, he doesn't want to be squinty in the picture. it's all about staging at these events, and he likes to try out the equipment, and he likes the scenes of him in a khaki shirt, you know, in his boots out there with the border guards. It's a very masculine, manly image, and he loves those pictures. So the border events are very picture heavy. Not much in the way of new proposals, new policies, or anything like that. It's more like a very muscular photo op.
Would it be for? Is it for television mostly?
Yeah, it's mostly for television.
Mm-hmm. And you all run pictures, so you would run pictures.
Yeah, I do stories as well. Sure, and I've done blog posts from his border events too.
Uh huh. And you take pictures.
Yeah, I do. I take a lot of my own sort of candid behind the scenes pictures.
Do you find that? Let's bring David in, because David, have you gone to any of these events?
Immigration? Yeah, I actually had a very memorable event. I don't know if you probably remember this, Julie. It was in
Yuma, I think.
Yeah,
it was.
We were on that together. I think we were on that together. It was hot. It was so hot.
It was so hot.
And he
did a lot of interviews.
Yeah, and he did that, all TV. And then there was one time where we thought the event was over. He had given his speech, and they took the entire White House press pool somewhere and just planted us in the middle of the desert. And he went out and was getting some briefings, and all of a sudden they came running in with this amazing urgency. He said, press, press, run, run, run. So we're literally like just bolting across the desert, all sweating all over the place. And we get to this spot where he's in a Border Patrol dune buggy. Uh-huh. And just riding along, bouncing around, waving at the cameras. And, you know, it's great for a radio reporter because it makes fantastic radio. But those images were all over television. But that was so clearly, I think Julie's absolutely right. It was all about the images. Sweaty in a dune buggy, I'm the man.
Yeah. And then, like, there were snakes, lots of snakes slithering around, and TV was getting those and everything else. He loves that.
When you go to that kind of event, what are you looking for?
It depends. I mean, if there's actual policy, you know, that would be interesting. But with immigration, there hasn't been that much new.
Yeah.
It was some of the color.
The fence stuff, was that, was a
not even
fence?
The fence was interesting, I think, at a later event closer to the midterm elections. But that was just, you know, that actually might have been the trip where he talked about sending National Guard units to the border,
which was a bit of
news. Uh-huh. But I remember that the stuff I was doing was trying the best I could to describe on radio what he looked like waving at cameras and smiling, you know, kind of goofy, you know, on a dune buggy.
It seems that immigration is an issue that they have tried about every different way you can to sell it.
It's in every State of the Union address. I mean, at least the last four or five, I think, right? And he just can't get it yet.
Yeah, and it's been one that's been particularly tough for every president. It's not just for him. It's been very difficult.
And a primetime address. I mean, you would know this better than we do. That's a pretty big deal when a president decides to do that and decide to do it on immigration, which is really you know, sticking his neck out.
But it doesn't seem to have gone very far.
It seems to me in a lot of ways they helped fan the notion that this was a crisis. They got people very worried about this as a crisis and now have been unable to solve it. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago or 5 years ago, if you asked people, is immigration a major issue? Well, you wouldn't have gotten the same numbers that you get now for their having, you know, sort of created it.
Well, but you also have just certain kinds of demographics about it, you know, people really fearing that they're losing their jobs. Mm-hmm. Like you look at around here, you know, in Herndon, Virginia, all of the difficulty about the laborers,
the day laborers,
mm-hmm. Looking for jobs in the morning, and all the Minutemen response.
Right, and that's everywhere now, including in Iowa, Nebraska.
What kind of stories have you been working on recently?
The reason I'm late is because I had to file something really quickly on this Office of Special Counsel that announced an investigation, that it was broadening investigation today. And I don't know about the two of you, I had never heard of the Office of Special Counsel until today. It's a tiny federal agency with only about 100 employees, and it's the director, the head of it is a presidential appointee, appointed by Bush, voted for Bush. And he's now investigating one of the firings of the U.S. attorneys to see whether, you know, there were White House email addresses involved.
Is that the Arkansas?
I think it's New Mexico, but it could broaden, it sounds like. And also looking at a PowerPoint presentation that happened earlier this year, one of the aides to Karl Rove talking to some government employees about 2008 political races. And it's all taking a look at whether they've violated the 1939 Hatch Act, which, you know, prohibits using government time, government money for political activities. So it doesn't appear, I have to look into it, Mir, it doesn't look like at first glance that they could actually enforce or prosecute anyone in the White House, but it's a big political embarrassment if this goes beyond, you know, Democrats looking at this, and now an independent agency and a political appointee from Bush actually studying this stuff.
Well, so when something like that comes down, where do you go for information? How do you develop the story?
something like this, really quickly, just filing, you know, like a 45-second thing for our air tonight. A lot of looking at the wires and looking up what the agency is and looking at what they've announced. But first thing tomorrow morning, I mean, I want to call the agency and see if we could get an interview with Scott Block, who heads the agency, and see if we can dig into what exactly he's looking at. Mm-hmm.
Both of you all have had changes in the way that you report from the White House, because you've both reported from the White House for newspapers, with you're now doing blogging, and you're now with radio. What is the difference for you, and what is the story, and how you get that story?
If it's on Julie's blog, it's a story, so I just follow whatever she's... No, I'm kidding. She is. She's the best known White House blog in the universe. It's radio is a little different because it something like immigration. If there wasn't the color of Bush riding in a dune buggy, and I couldn't get a little bit of excitement among editors talking about that. If there's not good sound, it gets tougher. Mm-hmm. It's on a day when Bush gives a speech about something, Iraq. Mm-hmm. If there are some good cuts of the president, some good, audio cuts of Harry Reid or someone, you can, build, mm-hmm. a kind of energy-filled story. But if the tape is pretty bland, then it's more of a challenge to make it into a good radio piece. And uh-huh. that never came into it as a print reporter.
As a print reporter, what did you look for?
Just news. And there were times when you wanted to write a fun feature story, something like that, and obviously there were other elements to it. But there's this added step that you're writing a radio piece around tape, mm-hmm. and that creates all sorts of new questions and issues, uh-huh. for better or for worse.
But do you assemble facts in the same way?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's more a structural difference, I think, that the core of a story is probably the same. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing a piece tomorrow about this investigation into Karl Rove's shop, mm-hmm. the story, it for both print or radio might be that here's a political appointee who is now investigating Karl Rove's shop, and that kind of, it's a new headache for President Bush. And it's, kind of broadens this investigation. It's related to the U.S. attorneys, but it's no longer just Democrats who are probing this. Uh-huh. The story's the same. But whereas, a print story, you find, a fresh, interesting way to write a news story, yeah. And has a lot of the elements. In radio, it might be, let's find a little audio of 1974 Office of Special Counsel investigation, whereas, uh-huh. In print, using that might be kind of bland. In radio, if you can find some interesting 10 or 15 second voice from years past of enforcing the Hatch Act, that might be a way to get into the story. This uh-huh. agency was created in, this year, and here's a little tape of 1970 and what they were investigating then, and now, in 2007, they're looking into, Karl Rove's shop, and here mm-hmm. are the things that are different 30 years later, here are the things that are the same. Uh-huh. So the news is the same, but I think just the structure would be a little yeah. different.
How many readers did you have when you were at The Sun? How many readers did you think of as having, and what did you see as your audience?
I think The Sun circulation was in the 400,000 mm-hmm. range, I think, maybe upper threes, uh-huh. 400,000. It's newspapers are changing. the laughter coming from over there. The mission of the Sun was that the Baltimore readers are very smart. They're very Washington savvy. They're close to the Beltway. They want, Washington and political news, but they were not going to do the incremental stories that the Washington Post is going to do. Mm-hmm. So in a given week, it's, if there's the U.S. attorney's flap, we might not have done four or five stories during a week, but Baltimore readers are going to expect when they wake up Saturday or Sunday morning to have a solid, you know, 30-inch analytical story about what's going on in Washington. So interested in Washington, knowledgeable about Washington, but not obsessed with Washington. I guess that's the way to put
it. Have you done much with the U.S. attorneys in the Houston Chronicle?
The paper's been running a lot of wire stories about it because Gonzalez is from Houston, so there's a real interest there. And I've been covering it more journalistically on my blog than any other subject. More sort of standard journalism. There's been humor and irreverence, but there's been also more journalism.
But can you show us the blog?
Okay.
And talk about the different types of stories that you do.
Okay.
Give us a sense of the range there.
All right. Let's look at it. I'll walk over here.
Can you pull up the blog?
Yes, we've got the blog.
How
cool is this?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm having allergies, so bear with me. I'm sorry.
Can you all see it okay?
Okay. Can you see it? All right. It's up. There it is.
We can see it.
Okay. All right. There it is. It's called Newswatch White House. And they made me start it when I was on a trip to India with Bush last year. They just sent me the instructions by email and said, just shut up and do it. I didn't want to do it. I think reporters blogging is dumb. I still do, kind of. But at the time, I was really dead set against it. I didn't want to do it. They made me do it. And then I started to like it. And I felt like, well, if I have to do this, I'm just going to make it as funny and as good as I can. And then after really less than a year of my doing it, they decided that I was going to do it full time. So now this is what I do.
How many people view it?
I get about between 30 and 60,000 hits a month, which isn't very good. It needs to go up more. I'm not even at Wonkette's level. And some of the other papers also have blogs, not really White House blogs, but other blogs, and they get about the same kind of traffic. So, also, interestingly, my blog editor recently told me that when I post about Dana Perino, my blog hits go way up. People are in love with her and just want pictures of her and information about her and just her. So I do, like, every day I try to mention Dana.
So do you have a combination of news from the White House, information on people?
I do. Yeah, I do. This one we're looking at right now, this is, like, just your basic post, you know, Cheney with a funny caption. It says, Cheney and his strange radiating halo call out Harry Reid's defeatism. And it's kind of irreverent, but I'm going to close this. And this, there's another one I wanted to show you, a post. I hope you can see this. It's called Stakeout. Can you see it? It's up there now. Yeah, okay. This is a kind of post that's really popular that I've been trying to do more of. And this is taking pictures of what we do at the White House that you wouldn't normally see on the news, that you wouldn't really see anywhere else. And we'll try to scroll down here.
Yeah,
scroll.
Describe it. Describe what the stakeout is.
The stakeout is in the White House driveway, we'll go out and wait for people to come out of meetings with the president and stand in the driveway and tell us what happened and what they were told and what was said. And we spend a lot of time just standing around in the driveway, just kind of, you know, making each other laugh and joking around. And then people come out of their meetings with the president. Here you see, these are just pictures of journalists standing around in the driveway. Okay, here come the Democratic leaders, and they're going to come out, and they're going to come to the microphone.
Usually come as separate groups? So in this case, it was they were talking about, was this about the supplemental?
Yeah, it was about the Iraq war funding. And the president met with Republicans and Democrats, but Democrats came out first to talk to us. And here you can see the picture of them. I take these pictures myself, and it's, you know, you can see Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, and the caption says, "The president is mean." And that was kind of the tenor of their meeting. I mean, they didn't come out and say that. You can see it's not in quotes. But and so, you know, then I have some dialogue that we had at the microphones there, and then, you know, more pictures of press, and people really like looking at this. They the feedback I get from readers is that it really humanizes journalists, which is always helpful, and kind of shows what the job
is. Possible.
Yeah, if possible. Doing my part for Ed Henry here. And it kind of shows what the job is like. like it's a lot of waiting around to get lied to by important people, and then sort of slogging around in the rain and things like that, and that it's huge scrums of reporters getting little crumbs of information from people, and they find it funny and very entertaining, and so the best feedback I get is from posts like this, rather than when I'm just covering sort of the news of the day.
How can they find your blog?
Okay, the address for the blog is blogs.cron.com/whitehouse And they want me to do like 5 posts a day, but I usually do about 3.
That seems like a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. It is a lot, especially these where I use my own pictures.
When you were doing just the straight reporting for the newspaper, how many stories a day did you write?
I do one story. And something interesting is that with the blog, I end up doing a greater variety of stories than I would when I was just simply writing for the newspaper, which I like a lot. I end up doing blog posts and reporting on things that the paper wouldn't be interested in, that they wouldn't waste the print on. But, you know, there's an endless amount of space on the Internet.
When do you start your blog? So how many times a day? If you say you do 3, is it on a regular kind of basis as far as time is concerned?
I try to do it within, like, the work day. When I get up, I try to have one up pretty quick before I come into the office, come into the White House, just so people can start debating it and chewing on it and stuff. And then I come into the White House and I'll do a few, 1 or 2, and then, you know, maybe 1 when I get home. And our reports show most people read blogs between 4 and 5 p.m., you know, at the end of their own work day. So that's also when I get the most traffic.
So they don't do it while they're on the job?
No, occasionally they do, but I find when I make inquiry that the people who are posting during the day either don't have jobs or work at home. But people in offices aren't really reading blogs. Just David and I.
David, how many stories do you do during an average day?
It varies a lot, and different kinds of stories.
Right. I mean, can you tell us what kinds you do?
Sure. I mean, today was a fairly typical day. I did 5 news spots, and those are at the beginning of every hour on NPR. We have a newscast, and so they have a bunch of like little, you know, 1 minute news spots. And so, you know, I did 5 today. I guess 4 on Bush and Iraq, and 1 on the thing that that we were talking about a minute ago.
Yeah.
But it really varies. I mean, there are 2 of us covering the White House, and so, you know, today my colleague, while I'm at the White House, kind of covering the daily stuff, my colleague Don Gagne was not on the air at all because he was getting ready to go to New Hampshire and catch up with John McCain.
Yeah.
And then he'll be doing a lot of stuff tomorrow. And, you know, if you're putting together like a 4 or 5 minute piece for one of our shows, you might do fewer of the news spots. But on a day at the White House, our newscast unit, they're people who just sit there like hungering for any news that you can give them.
Uh-huh.
And the White House, you know, is anything is news from the White House to them. So on a day when I'm not doing a piece for one of our shows, you know, they'll just, I mean, literally with their mouths open, I could give them anything and they'll take anything and get. I mean, they're great, they're fantastic journalists, but their job is to just get the most recent up-to-date news on the air as quickly as possible.
Uh-huh. When that tree got hit by lightning on the White House lawn, was that news for you?
I don't think so. I was in town for that. That I don't think. But just, I have to say, as funny as it is, they are very good at judging. I mean, you know, like the Indianapolis Colts, which I thought was kind of newsy since I'm a huge football fan.
Yesterday,
they were like, "Yeah, interesting." No,
no. But also, Martha had asked about your audience before, and so it was like 400,000. But you know what your audience is now.
Yes, what's your audience now?
It varies. It depends on what time. You know, if you're doing a news spot that airs at 11 o'clock at night, you know, it might be, you know, 200,000 to 300,000 people listening to NPR, but during the big show times like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, I think it's in the
24
4,
million.
5, 6 million range, maybe at a given moment, but it's like something like 24, 25 million, I think, during a week listening to NPR at some point.
So when you're preparing stories, you're thinking of a national audience.
Yeah.
Are there any times when you do stories for particular stations?
Not usually pieces, but I might go on one of our member stations. If like today, WNYC, our member station in New York, called to ask. They thought that I was traveling with the president in New York, and they called to ask if I could do what, in radio terms, and these are the terms that I never knew as a print reporter, if I could do a debrief, which means them calling me, sticking me on the air, and saying, like, so, you know, here's White House correspondent David Greene traveling with the president. What, you know, what did he say in New York? What was the school that he visited? What was his message? So then all of a sudden you go into this mindset. And 9/11, the 9/11 anniversary, it was a challenge because I was talking to our newscast unit, talking about, you know, the day, 9/11, the anniversary, the president visiting New York. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm on WNYC and I realized that, you know, the news is the same, but all of a sudden you're talking to all New Yorkers who, you know, have a very different perspective on 9/11. And I found myself talking much more about, you know, New York City firefighters and their reaction to the president and what the scene was like on the Lower East Side. Yeah. And you could talk about these things in a way that, you know, New Yorkers would know a heck of a lot more than I did about it, but it was more focused on that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Okay. Let's go to some questions. You all have some questions there?
Question about you write a blog, but do you read any blogs? That question is to both of you.
That's an interesting question. I do. I read a lot of blogs, but I don't read media criticism blogs, because I just can't stand it. And I don't read a lot of the political blogs that are very popular, like Daily Kos and things like that. I just don't read them. I read Fishbowl DC, and I read the other news organization blogs. The Chicago Tribune has a good blog, and Cox News has a good blog, and obviously Romanesco, which is a big sort of media news blog, and those are the ones I really stick to. I also love Paris Hilton and Pink is the New blog, and I love celebrity gossip, and that's really what I read.
Yeah, you should show us your pictures. Julie did pictures of the White House Correspondents Association dinner.
It was all about finding Sanjay.
And you caught up with him, correct?
Well, no, April did.
April did.
And he loved April.
And he looked frightened.
What blogs do you do?
I don't read a lot of blogs. I read Julie's blog. And because I thought about Julie on a day like this when it was this ridiculously childish spat between Harry Reid and Dick Cheney.
I loved it.
And I had to report this as if it were news. And I wish that I could have, you know, done it in an irreverent kind of look at Washington sort of way, because that would have been the way to report today. Uh-huh. Because them, you know, spouting off at each other. I mean, it's just
I did
ridiculous.
Enjoy that when Harry Reid said,
I'm not going to call names.
Calling
attack dog.
Someone with a 9% approval
rating.
Yeah,
exactly.
Great stuff.
But I'm with Julie. I avoid some of the political blogs on either side. Because we get so many emails from people on both sides who just go crazy complaining about our news coverage. That's enough for me.
It's very
And I know that they're reading the blogs and then firing their emails to us.
How many emails do you get from readers? Let's say on a normal day, how many would you get?
It really varies. I mean, today one came in from a piece I did 3 days ago. But if it's something that aired that shows up in a liberal or conservative blog, that generates people writing to us. So then it might be 20 or 30 after, you know, one piece airs, just pouring in.
Have you figured out who the people are who write you?
I think they're blog readers a lot of the time. Because
who are they, do you think?
I don't know. Julie might know this better, but it's people. But something triggers them, because there'll be a day where, you know, we have a policy like the New York Times where we call President Bush, on first reference. Does the New York Times still call him Mr. Bush?
I think they call him Mr. Bush on second reference.
We call the president Mr. Bush on second reference. And a lot of conservatives think that that's not respectful. It's actually really offensive. And so, you know, I call him that every day, but there'll be you know, one day out of every month on average, that all of a sudden I'll get 50 emails saying, you know, that is completely offensive. You know, how can you call the President of the United States Mr. Bush? And I know it's because somewhere, you know, someone who's a well-read blog put that in his or her blog, and it's just, you know, so many readers that, bam, you know, they're just, how could NPR do that?
Do you respond to your readers?
I've actually gotten in trouble for responding to readers. It was awful. It was after the hurricane, and I'd been working 5 weeks straight without a day off, and I was exhausted, and some reader wrote me about, you know, y'all just hate President Bush, and I just sent her back some little snippy remark, and she sent it to the editor of the paper. I got in quite a lot of trouble. So now my policy is, if someone writes me a nice note, I say thank you very much, which is very infrequent. And usually when I get hate mail, I just read it and delete it.
Can you show us your pictures from the...
From the correspondence dinner.
Dinner, yeah.
Yes, I can.
Yeah. So good.
I really need a new camera. That's my latest thing. I'm trying to get them to give me a new camera. and it's only a few $100.
What was your general take on the dinner? You know, there are a lot
worst
of articles that were that are critical. They're critical of the notion that reporters and officials get together. And what do you all think, really, about the relationship and what kind of contacts?
I think that's a really unsophisticated and sort of immature view of how we do our job, that we are not allowed to be friendly. Being friendly with your sources doesn't mean that you're nice to them when you sit down and write a story. It helps in the news gathering when you can schmooze. And somehow the notion that we couldn't have dinner with sources and then be fair to them, it seems very stunted in a way. It seems a real lack of understanding about how journalists work. People aren't likely to return my calls if they don't know me. And, you know, and it helps to develop those relationships. Mm-hmm. And the dinner is really inconsequential. I've brought people to the dinner who never spoke to me again, who I had hoped to cultivate as sources. It really doesn't, you know, really doesn't do much. Uh-huh. In that, I don't know what David's view is.
Uh-huh. No, I agree with you. There's one moment in the dinner every year that bothers me, and that's the toast to the president. I don't understand why that's done. I don't see any problem at all with reporters and sources and people from the administration and all over government and journalists getting together on one big evening and, you know, listening to the president speak, listening to some comedy. I mean, that's the point of this, you know, a lot of this city. It's, you know, reporters are there to get information, and the best way to do that is to cultivate sources. But I don't, there's something every single year that bugs me when they say, let's raise a glass to the president, because that, especially for people who cover the president, you know, that feels like that is the only thing that I feel like is crossing the line a little bit.
True.
I don't want to be sitting there raising a glass to this, you know, politician who I need to cover in an unbiased way every day.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, that makes me uncomfortable.
Well, do you think it's a, in a sense, it's a toast to the office?
Yeah. I mean, and I could see that.
And it probably started.
As that.
You know, in 1913.
Yeah.
When it
doesn't bother me enough that I would, that I wouldn't do it, but it's still.
Or that you wouldn't go. Yeah. So what is the mixture at the dinner? Mixture of things.
It's thousands and thousands of people, and it's too many celebrities, and there's, 150 or 200 actual White House correspondents, and lots of sources and news executives and things like that. And every year it's a big deal. It's a fundraiser for journalism scholarships, which is terrific, and we're able to, the association is able to charge their usurious prices for tickets because the president goes every year, because we get all these celebrities. We certainly couldn't pay those rates for anything less. But so people show up, and here's some pictures. Here's Apollo Ono, who was there. It's kind of a blurry picture. This is what the outdoor terrace looks like when everyone's sort of hanging around beforehand. Mm-hmm. Everyone was looking for Sanjaya.
I wonder why.
Yeah, there's a little picture of me getting kissed by Dana Milbank of the Washington Post, who I have a little bit of a crush on.
For purposes of full disclosure.
Yes, I mean, you know, let's just put it out there. And and I'd gotten a fake tan, but it does look like I was deeply flushed. Here's the president laughing. He had a horrible time. You could tell he hated it. You know, it was just a miserable evening for him. He had actually, I'd heard he tried to get out of it, because using Virginia Tech as an excuse. Yeah. These are just pictures of reporters at the dinner. You know, most of the photos you see of the dinner are all of the celebrities there. So I kind of tried to take pictures of just regular people who cover the White House.
Uh-huh. At one point, Steve Scully, who was president of the association, asked White House correspondents to stand up, people who regularly cover the White House, which is the first time I think that that's been done. But one of the things that that struck you right off was how few people there were.
Yeah, and we really feel like third-class citizens that are, I didn't get invited to any after parties, and I actually cover the White House. You know, it's all these A-listers, and I'm D-listed.
It's the people out of town that seem to be.
Yeah, it's the out-of-town people.
To be the focus.
Yeah, they really are, and it's too bad. I mean, the White House Press Photographers Association has a great party every year, and it's just them and their editors, and it's very intimate and, you know, drunken. But it's just it's a much better event than our event. There's Karl Rove. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you heard about how he got attacked by Sheryl Crow at the dinner, and it's all the rage.
Yeah, I don't want Terry Hatcher there next year.
No, we don't need Terry Hatcher.
Absolutely.
All right, I'm just gonna scroll down and find April and Sanjaya. Yeah, there's Rich Little, who was the entertainment. He was awful. But his only funny joke was he was doing an impression of Nixon, and he was, like, waggling his face, and he said, "I'm having a jowl movement." That was, like, the only laugh. There's Condi Rice. Yeah, okay, all right, we're looking for April.
Yeah, they talked to April.
They talked to April, okay, yeah, so you know April.
And Suzanne Malvo and Bill Plant.
Oh, yeah. There's
and
Katie Couric showing
wow,
a little cleavage.
That,
Tom
is, a, that is a group.
Yeah.
Okay, there's April and Sanjaya. And as you can see, if you can see the picture, he does look a little scared of her. She sent me that picture Sunday morning. I didn't actually take it. But she had her BlackBerry in church, and I was messaging her frantically saying, "Send me that picture."
In church.
And she was in church. She was like, "As soon as I get out of church, I'm going to send it to you."
How does April do this? I'm a huge Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and when the Steelers came to the White House, like, all I wanted to do was meet Jerome Bettis. And I'm like wandering through the audience, and there's April with her arm around him, just like, you know, making nice. And she's amazing. She's truly amazing.
Of course, she got an interview with Shaquille O'Neal. Also,
incredible.
Anybody have a question? Another question? Next one up.
My question is for Mr. Green. Can you tell us a little bit about how the pace of the news differs in radio than working for a paper like The Sun?
About the White House specifically or in general?
Well, in general, mention that on NPR you do a spot, there's a new spot every hour for about 5 minutes. So does that put a little bit more pressure on you to come up with stories?
Yeah, I think the pace at the White House is really different. In newspaper, your day was sort of shaped. You wake up, you cover stuff, your deadline is always, you know, whenever. 6, 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interviewing people, it's having lunch, and then around, you know, 2, 3 o'clock, you're suddenly like, oh my, I have to start writing. At 4 o'clock, you're like, oh my, I haven't started writing. And then at, you know, 6 o'clock, your editors are bothering you to get something in. In radio, I would say the stress is more evenly distributed with little pockets of it. Like, you know, I might come in at 9:30 in the morning and they might decide that they want me, you know, to go on our morning show, morning edition at 10:15, right after the president says something. So all of a sudden it's, you know, 15 minutes of getting ready and deciding what in the world I'm going to say and jumping on the air. And then it's, you know, an hour of breathing again. And then there might be another pocket of stress leading up to doing a piece for our show, All Things Considered, in the afternoon. And then it's calm again. So it's a little different. In general, a lot of it's the same. I was in Blacksburg, kind of taken off the White House beat all last week, and I was talking to a lot of print reporters who were down there, and it was similar. It depended on whether you were, you know, doing, you know, a story that was on deadline, if you had a couple days to think about it, and you know, it varied depending on what sort of story you were doing. And I think that's the same in radio and print.
When you went there. How did the stories develop? What did they want you to do And what kinds of stories did they want?
It was all different kinds of stories. I mean, they needed people, especially in the first couple of days, to be on the air every hour, you know, with the update on the investigation. And then there were some stories they wanted you to really step back, and they tried to give everyone sort of a mix so no one got, you know, too drained. And it also depended on what sort of state people were in, because it was, you know, covering it and talking to a lot of families, it was, you know, constantly, I think editors were asking reporters, are you okay doing this? And if not, should we have someone else do this story? But for me, it was a day of, you know, being on from, you know, 5 in the morning until 6, 7 at night on the first day after the shootings. And it was hard. You know, they wanted you to go on and kind of describe the latest every few minutes. And, uh-huh. and then the following 2 days, it was spending a lot of time talking to two families whose, each of them had a kid who was shot, but they were in the hospital and survived. Mm-hmm. And that had its own challenges, but it was, uh-huh. it wasn't as much the stress of getting on air. Uh-huh. It was spending 2 days really getting to know these people and these families, and then uh-huh. putting together, you know, longer term piece.
Uh-huh. Can I ask something about that? Was doing that exhilarating after the sort of scripted stuff we cover at the White House? Was that just? I mean, you said it was exhausting, but what is it also like? Great.
It was. It was. It's hard to describe something so tragic as yeah, I mean, I
right,
totally
you know
see
what
you're
mean.
Saying.
I don't mean that it's great to cover, but to
professionally,
be
it was great to get out of the White House and actually be with real people. Mm-hmm. But it also, I mean, that it was for better and worse, because it was also, you don't get the same kind of emotional attachment to it that you do at the White
True.
House.
So it was emotionally
it was very
draining
different,
and,
yeah, but doing something
hard.
Different was great.
And did it kind of remind you why you got into the biz?
Yeah, but the media horde in Blacksburg was sickening.
Yuck.
It was, you know, every single, and it's hard to complain because, you know, we were part of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, you walked up to a student and the first thing you wanted to say was, you know, I'm so sorry. And, mm-hmm. you know, they would say to me, like, thank you for being so nice. And it was like, look, you know, it's my job as a human to be nice. And I want to know why you're saying that. Like, what were the last 10 people? What did they do? So you got the sense that every student was just, you know, going through the worst possible thing you could go through and yet being attacked by one journalist after another. It was just awful. And, you know, it was every single television affiliate in the entire country, it seemed like, had brought a satellite truck and just descended on this campus.
Oh, God, that's awful.
So it was really, that part was really, really disappointing.
Uh-huh. What coverage will you have now from this point on? Of Virginia Tech.
I'm following one family who's the same family. Their daughter just got out of the hospital yesterday. She was in the French class in Norris Hall, and it was a stunning story. She thinks that she was spared only because she was holding her hand and was shot and had, you know, blood all over her face, and so she thinks the shooter thought that she was that he had, you know,
mortally wounded her,
right. and so moved on to other people. So she had some really tense days in the hospital, and she's now out and home in Pittsburgh. So, you know, I think I'm going to follow her at some point. But other than that, it's back to the White House.
Right. Did you get taken off? Not frequently, but occasionally, do you get taken off to do other kinds of stories?
More for the political campaign. Don and I are finding now that, you know, one of us is at the White House in a given week, and the other one is doing a political story.
I see.
But this was doing something very unrelated. Right. I think they were just looking for hands
so close.
To. Yeah, I mean, it was just finding people in the newsroom and getting them to Blacksburg as quickly as possible.
Do you find that the White House is it winding down? Do you see the administration winding down?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and there's
and
so
how do you
little
see
interest
it?
At my paper for White House News. Mm-hmm. They don't care. They don't think the readers care. There's not that appetite. You know, it sort of becomes old hat.
Are they interested in the campaign? Are readers interested in viewers, listeners interested in the campaign?
It's a weird time because I think news organizations are interested in the campaign because it's a new, fresh thing. And I would say listeners are more interested in that than your given day at the White House right now. But I think it's a weird time. His White House coverage is kind of winding down. And at the same time, you know, the Democrats haven't made any sort of compelling storyline to interest people. You know, after the midterms, I mean, it's, you know, it's, I think a lot of listeners view the debates between the Democrats and President Bush over Iraq as getting old. And meanwhile, I think they think the campaign is happening too early.
Yeah, it's a little flat right now.
Mm-hmm. Another question? Notice the change. You came in the Clinton administration.
No, I started with Bush, so I couldn't compare.
You didn't cover Clinton at all?
I was here as an intern for a little while. Uh-huh. So yeah. I actually think I first met you when I was. Yeah.
I thought I remembered you in Clinton.
But compared to the stories about, you know, a lot of the, you know, going out for drinks and so forth with White House officials, it seems like there's a lot less of that.
Yeah.
Now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Certainly in the first term they were a lot more closed up. Now you can sort of see administration officials out a little bit more with reporters, but
why do you think that that they've loosened up? I mean, there are several ways in which you can see some loosening in the White House. The president has gone to more events where an audience was not a hand-picked audience and where he's taken questions. You find him doing more solo press conferences. There are more officials than there were in the first term that are doing briefings. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's a crowd, but there's a somewhat more of a tendency to do it. Is the change worth much? And if so, why has it come about?
Well, we saw right before the election, Bush was doing, as you said, more of those sort of unscripted Q&A with the audiences that were very random rather than handpicked supporters. And that, it went pretty well for him. I mean, he could think on his feet and give good answers, but it didn't get them much in terms of the election. It didn't really, and so they've stopped doing that lately. You haven't seen since the election, we haven't had any of those. And I don't think the administration officials are any more accessible. I think when they're having a bad day and things aren't going their way, they become very hostile and they don't return calls. But they sort of loosen up a little bit when they think they're starting to earn some points. But that's all I have to say about that.
Do you find any differences?
I think it varies. I mean, there are some times when you would see Rove all of a sudden go out on off-the-record dinners that I at least wasn't invited to. but you would find out about them at times when he was in real legal trouble, and you would get the sense like maybe all of a sudden he's realizing, gosh, maybe I could make a difference by, you know, kind of giving my side of the story to people.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Not that it would help him at all, but. But then the president had, you know, had a number of off-the-record sessions with reporters, and it seemed to be part of a strategy at a time where they decided that it's been a lot of negative news coverage, and let's at least try to humanize him. And mm-hmm. whether it worked or not, I don't know.
Uh-huh. One person that we talked to, because the students came in to the White House and you know, talked to a group of people individually, and one person who was in one of the sessions that was a particularly long session said that while the president is much looser and more comfortable in that kind of setting, that he didn't really think that there was anything that was different that the president was saying. It's just how he said it.
Yeah, I was in one in the first wave of them, I guess maybe 2 years ago or a year and a half, and not this, and I felt like I learned a lot about him, and you know, I was you know, struck by, you know, knowing the names of books that people were reading. I mean, going around the room and asking what books people were reading, and he clearly knew every single one, which, you know, is not the perception I have of George W. Bush, and it was things like that, but it wasn't anything new in terms of news that I got. A lot of it, what he said, was the same talking points. And I didn't get anything that I think would shape my coverage of him in a different way. Uh-huh. It was kind of the kind of things you're like, wow, that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
Glad I got to see that side of him. Okay, uh-huh. You know, I'm moving on now.
Yeah, because most presidents do those kinds of sessions.
More often than he does?
No, I mean, they do them about the same way, that when they're in a period where their popularity is low and they think that it is because not of their policies, but if people only understood the president better, that they would be more likely to support him. And so they tend to bring people in. In earlier administrations, a lot of them were dinners. And I don't think that they bought very much. They ever have bought very much. Because reporters are going to report what's news.
Right.
More questions?
I think there's been coverage more over and over. Because I don't get a sense that journalists are there anymore. At least it seems that way to me. It seems like journalists cover more politicians and not what just happened.
Can you get closer to the microphone? Because we only caught part of it. We know that it's on Iraq and Iraq coverage.
Do you think journalists have much of a politician?
Soldiers are not supposed to talk, are they?
No, but...
So that's...
Well, so you're asking besides politicians about what's going on over there.
We actually had a piece that was on this morning. We reached a soldier in Iraq, an intelligence officer, and it was really hard to find someone who would talk because they're basically breaking the law and they could be court-martialed. But we thought it was worth... you know, doing anything we could to get a voice, you know, from there on the air. I feel like it is definitely a challenge. And I think a lot of what is aired and in print is more George W. Bush and Democrats in Congress than it should be. But at the same time, I mean, I think there's a good mix of stories about military communities, about what Americans think about the war, interviewing as many Iraqis as news organizations possibly can in the climate over there. It's certainly not going to be enough, and there should be more. But I hope that they get it, you know, that people get more than politicians sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
How is your paper covering the war?
We've been in and out of Iraq. It's hard to, the insurance is very expensive, and that's a cost that a lot of people don't realize is to insure a reporter, especially as a family, to go over there. It's just cost prohibitive. So we have reporters in and out. We don't have a constant presence there. Like, I think NPR has someone there pretty much the whole time, but we've been in and out. And Embedded, which the paper liked very much because our reporter was able to embed with a Texas-based unit that was, you know, really seeing a lot of combat, and he got to know those soldiers very well, and it was great. And this was a seasoned war correspondent who sort of knew the drill and didn't make mistakes, and sent back really beautiful, nuanced stories about how it was for the soldiers and how it was for the Iraqis and how it looked from where he was, and obviously not a picture of the entire war, but just what this one unit was seeing, and so. Taken for itself, it was not a comprehensive look at the war, but when you look at the scope of war reporting, like I said, I think all the elements are being covered.
Mm-hmm. What is your view about the coverage? And did you serve in Iraq? Because I do have a student.
Dr. Kumar, I saw you this afternoon. I'm pretty sure I didn't go over there. It's not Jason. I mean, next time you go over there, take me with you, I guess. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, no, we do have somebody in the class who has served in Iraq.
He's probably over there.
Okay, another question?
Well, it's hard to know, man. Who's asking the questions?
Come on, come up with another one.
Who would you describe the audience that listens to NPR and then the audience that reads the Houston Chronicle? Who are your readers and who are you aiming your stories at?
Well, I'll go first. My readers, I think, tend to be a lot of people. Well, I know the White House staff reads my blog, and I know that White House reporters all read my blog. I try to keep Texans in mind when I'm writing it, but since it's on the internet, everyone can read it, and I have a regular reader in Germany who's a big George Bush fan, and I have lots of readers who hate the media but can't get enough of reading a newspaper blog about the White House. And so it's really disparate. It's all over the place, and it's very varied. But I will say that the comments I get generally run according to public opinion about the president. Right now it's about 70% of them hate Bush and about 30% love him, and that's pretty much what the polls show, which is interesting.
We actually, I was surprised when I came to NPR 2 years ago that the breakdown of our listeners, if you poll them, is a third of them identify themselves as liberal, a third of them identify themselves as conservative, and a third of them somewhere in the middle, which stunned me given the, you know, the view of NPR sometimes. But the biggest thing you can say about our listeners is they're usually in cars. and that's often what I'll be thinking about. I mean, I listen to NPR, I listen to Morning Edition, a morning program, and I was waking up. So when I'm, you know, with a morning piece on, I'm trying to think about people who are kind of groggy and who might only hear like two-thirds of the piece, who are just waking up in the morning. They don't want to hear something that's like really loaded with, you know, tough stuff to understand. I mean, they would want something, you know, a little easier to kind of start their day. And then I imagine our listeners in the afternoon, on all things considered, at, you know, 5:30, sitting in a traffic jam and, you know, having spent a day kind of knowing what's going on and wanting to know the news of the day, maybe something that is a little, you know, denser, but something that's not going to make them fall asleep while they're driving.
Another one?
Entire White House, because the news is so coming from one way. People like Helen Thomas are more exceptions to the norm than the rule. Where do you guys see yourselves' careers moving on? Would you like to stay at the White House or try and get your feet wet in something else?
Yeah, that's a tough one. The White House was my goal, my professional goal for so long. I came up through city government and county government and the state legislature and politics and presidential politics, and the White House was always, you know, this shiny thing in the distance, and now having achieved it, I'm trying to work out what the next thing I want to do is. I would like to stay on the White House for much longer. I'd like to become really good at it and really know what I'm talking about. Helen, yeah, obviously someone who's been there that long, and she's a columnist now, so that's a little different. But sure, I'd like to stay at the White House longer, and I don't really know what I want to do after that.
Yeah, and you could see, obviously, you know, you're going to be able to see another administration in 2009.
Well, I hope. I mean, it's expensive to cover the White House, and it's for a paper like mine that has a bureau of, you know, we fluctuate between 6 and 10 people, and you have to think to yourself, what kind of resources do we want to put at the White House? I mean, right now, there's a Texan in the White House, so the Chronicle can justify it. But papers like the Boston Globe and the Dallas Morning News don't have White House correspondents anymore. They just don't come. They don't cover it. And they just run wire. And so you kind of have to see if they're going to want to do that or put me on something else.
Mm-hmm. What about you, David?
I actually came to the White House accidentally and never was obsessed with the idea of covering it, but have absolutely loved it and feel really honored to have had that kind of window in history. But it's also not something I would want to do forever, because to me, at some point, you start to lose the perspective of what else is going on in the world. And I really felt that when I went to Blacksburg, that, you know, covering real, you know, stories of tragedy or stories of, you know, other types of stories can really make you see that there's a world out there. And it gets to the point of one of your students, you know, the covering the Iraq War, for example, from just, you know, when you do it from just politicians' point of view, you're not getting anywhere near what the, you know, the scope of the story. So it's fantastic. But I would love to, you know, I'd love to go abroad and be in one of our foreign bureaus at some point in the future. And I think being somewhere in the country, you know, Chicago, Boston, and, you know, covering kind of a region of the country and telling interesting stories would be a lot of fun. But but for now, the White House is fascinating.
That does sound fun. I want to do that. Do that.
You and me.
Yeah.
Okay. Some more questions? Let's take, we still have time.
Some of the people we've spoken with don't really consider blogs a valuable news source. What would you have to say to that?
I think blogs are trivial and silly, and they're no substitute for news. And that's why I have very mixed feelings about it. I'm doing it now because I really wasn't given a choice. They called me in and said, well, we're not going to cover the White House anymore, but, you know, we want you to blog it. And so it was a way for me to keep covering the White House and do it in a way that was new, and it's a lot of fun. But I agree. I think blogs, even news blogs, are really, they're not the full picture. They're not a substitute for real news gathering. They're a supplement. They're entertainment. And I would really like to get back to real news coverage someday.
What is it that is an element of a blog story that makes it different from a regular news story, even on a website that is sponsored by a news organization?
It's not as complete. It's not as full. It doesn't really have the same rigorous standards as a news story. I post stuff on the blog that's just what Bush said. You know, and I don't have to bother with getting React or filling it out or filling it in or pointing out his inconsistencies. There's other things that you do get in a blog that you can't get in the newspaper. Like, I use a lot of humor and irreverence, which is something I think has been completely washed out of newspapers and TV news coverage, unfortunately. And so I do think I provide a valuable public service in that realm. But it's unserious. And its lack of seriousness and the fact that people do rely on it and believe what they read on blogs, news blogs, I have to be accurate and I have to be fair and I don't take positions on things like that. But, you know, a lot of people do, and that's unfortunate because people are using them as substitutes for news.
In ones that are sponsored by news organizations, what's the editorial process?
Well, it varies. For example, I have an editor. All my blog posts go through editors who read for content and spelling, and they've saved me, just like newspaper editors used to. But I know, for example, Cox News and Chicago Tribune, they don't go through editors. They just post, the reporter writes it, and it goes right up on the web, and there's none of that filtering process. And I know those reporters have said that they would like to have more editing on the blog than they get.
Mm-hmm. But there's some phenomenon going on. When I do pieces, the 10 pieces that I do about the news of Bush's day, you know, don't get, you know, we track our emails at NPR, emailed stories. I mean, they're like, they don't even register. And then I'll do a piece kind of bringing Bush to life, you know, and on a foreign trip, what he was eating and how, you know, how he was acting right. with foreign leaders. And I mean, they are emailed all over the place. So there's, mm-hmm. and Julie could do that sort of story in you know, in your space, you know, anytime you wanted
right,
to, and
I never get it
and
in the
I can't
right.
could never get in the newspaper.
Never get it in the newspaper.
And so, if there's that appetite, and you say, okay, like this is what readers want, then the question is, would you rather have someone like Julie, who's a you know a seasoned White House reporter, you know, doing it, or someone who has their own blog? I mean, that's what strikes me as such a difficult thing to figure out right now in journalism. The
right,
appetite
but,
is there, and how do you give people what they...
But someone with their own blog wouldn't really have access to the president on a foreign trip.
Right.
Right. So I go back and forth on that myself. Like, this is really fun, and I love to do it, and it's great, but it's unserious, and I didn't spend 20 years clawing my way through local news to write funny ditties on a blog, so...
Yeah. Was that from Mexico, where the president was
eating a lot.
Yeah, throughout Latin America.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, I remember that piece. Do you have some more? One more.
What relationship have with editors on a day-to-day basis? Do they suggest stories? Do you largely suggest stories? Could you describe the process a little bit?
Yeah, that relationship is so, so key to journalism. I think Julie would agree. I mean, that can, you know, the difference between a happy and an unhappy journalist, I think, can often come down to the relationship with your editor. And I'm so lucky right now because I have someone whose judgment I really believe in, who I can call, you know, early in the day and kind of say, this is news, this isn't news. And if he disagrees, I trust him. We could have that conversation, you know, early on, and to get to one of your questions, it varies a lot. I mean, I might spot something and call my editor earlier in the day and say, I really feel like this could be a neat story, and you know, he'll often trust me and say, go for it. Or he might call me and say, you know, we really want to pour attention into this and get a piece on the air. But it that relationship is so critical. I mean, I remember, you know, getting an email at 11 o'clock at night a week or two ago about, you know, from one of our top people at NPR about, you know, a story that was they saw on the New York Times website. And I immediately said, you know, this isn't really a story. It's not something we need to jump on. And my editor just jumped in with an email, you know, right away saying, like, I agree, period. And it's like that's the moment when you, like, celebrate a good editor. So it's there's no real structure to it, but it's conversations that happen, you know, all during the day. And you want to have someone who you really, you know, trust their judgment and know that they're looking out for you, which is a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you.
Oh, me, yeah, I'm largely unsupervised. I come up with all my own ideas. I mean, I'm edited. My words are edited, and sometimes they'll suggest something, but they really just kind of, you know, they feel like I know what I'm doing. I'm the one who's here. I know what's going on. So every now and then something will come over the transom. I'm like, do you think this might be something? But most of the time it's just I come up with it. Uh-huh. And, yeah, I agree. The relationship with an editor is so key.
How do you all prepare for your day? What do you read, and what do you listen to, and what do you watch when you get up in the morning?
Well, I start with NPR. I get so many ideas off NPR. and the Post, of course, and I get up and I immediately read, like, all the papers and check the schedules and see what's coming up for the day and things like that. It's not really that different from newspaper reporting.
Uh-huh. What papers do you read?
I read the Post and, you know, the New York Times, I try to read it every day, but, God, it's, like, so much work. And I read the Texas papers online.
Uh-huh. What about you, David?
I'm usually reading the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny, I'm not reading newspapers, you know, and kind of being up on the news takes so much space in your brain, I think, because you have to read so much to make sure you're, you know, kind of ready for anything at the White House. That one weakness I feel like is I'm reading so fewer books and so forth about history and than I used to, which is one thing I'm looking forward to if I am no longer covering the White House. Like, I don't have to worry about reading, you know, newspapers top to bottom every day. I can actually find, you know, oh my, I could look in my library and read anything I want right now, which would be fantastic.
Were you all surprised that Bush read, how many books is he supposed to have read last year?
Was that ever validated?
Yeah.
I'm
wondering how he could have fit that in his day. It's supposed to be 73, right?
Right. Well, you remember he said that he was reading these books on, you know, what, germs and all this other, these highfalutin tomes. And then some reporters went to the ranch to ride bikes with him, and they asked him, Mr. President, what are you reading? And he said, Elmore Leonard.
Uh-huh.
He was just reading some novel that was not on his list of 87,000 books that he was going to read.
Yeah.
But I think he has more time than we realize. You would know this, President Kumar, more than me. I mean, I'm fascinated by, you know, the stories of Lyndon Johnson and Mike. You're managing the war at 4 o'clock in the morning from the Oval Office,
and going to the Situation
Room. Being up all night worrying about. I mean, I just don't get. You know, Bush talks about being a delegator, but I think it's true.
He says he gets a good night's sleep, and I think that's.
I think
true
he does,
well.
And I think he has the time at 8 o'clock at night to be, you know, sitting in bed and reading a good book for a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people wouldn't be happy that he's spending that time doing that instead of other things. But is that the sense that you get?
Well, there is a lot that's done for a president. I mean, he lives where he works, so he doesn't have commuting
time. That's true.
And he doesn't have to go out and get the cleaning and doesn't have to prepare a meal. So
right.
So there certainly are a lot of corner cutters. But another thing is that he does not go out and socialize, that they stay in much more than any president I can remember and do less entertaining than any president.
Right.
But part of that is the wartime footing. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
pleasure.
It. Yeah.
Thanks for your questions.
Thank you for your questions.
Thank you.
No, one thing I've asked, do you all have any questions of the students?
I'd like to know what blogs they read.
Julie wants to know what blogs you read.
They don't read any.
Yeah, because they were saying none.
None.
One of the people we interviewed in when they came into the White House and asked them that, and almost nobody read a blog.
Really?
Yeah.
What's been your impression of the White House press corps? And you won't offend anybody, just
yeah.
since you've seen so many members.
Okay, who wants to take that?
Suzanne Malveaux is the best looking.
All right, I'm offended.
Yeah. okay. All righty.
All right, thanks.
Good night.